Okay, this is the first place I'm sharing about what I've been quietly working on. It's called the Mental Fitness Blueprint. It's a 90-day deeply personal map for training your mind to work for you, not against you. And I'm opening this up to just 50 founding members. So if this podcast has ever helped you slow down or see yourself more clearly, this is your invitation. Details are in the show notes or at mchampagne.com. Cecily, who are you?
Oh, it's the Mark question. You're right. Oh my gosh, what a great one. You know, one thing I definitely am is impermanent. So my answer to that question is going to change every day. And I think today I feel a little bit like a kid. I feel like a young version of myself having just another day of learning and awakening. And that's because I was awakened this morning by a dream where I was having a meeting with a council of elders who happened to be...
Go.
I know!
Let's go.
Sorry, this doesn't happen all the time either, by the way, so very coincidental. Listeners, it's 10:30 in the morning Pacific time, so yeah. I'm only a few hours into my day. I'm still metabolizing this. I woke up from this dream that I was having this conversation with this council of elders, and not just any elders, but my 82-year-old father who was living, his past 84-year-old sister with whom I was very close, and then their father, my grandpapa George, who was born in 1906 and died about 30 years ago. And these are three really powerful people in my life, and they were just having a little check-in with me about big life events happening. And wanting to make sure that I was making decisions that were going to help me be happy in the long run. And so this, you know, since opening my eyes pre-dawn, today I'm a kid.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to pull this thread. So you don't know this, but because I just shared a very brief version of what this next book is, but every morning for probably almost a year, I've been spending time, kind of in the environment that you're talking about, interviewing using AI, but interviewing ancient teachers from the past. And I have a council of 14 of them. You're literally using the exact same word. Carl Jung, Rumi, Maya Angelou, Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
So I've been really fascinated with having these conversations. As soon as you said dream, so I've had a few of these myself recently. If you're open to it, I would bring your dream to Carl Jung through AI. And because he's got a lot of really interesting work around dreams and for me at least have been dropping like really insightful questions to, you know, help the guidance continue and so forth.
So cool.
And you can have a chat in the first person essentially, and you just do an audio note, and it's really powerful. But I'm curious, so when you woke up, did it feel like a dream or a visitation?
So it felt more like a visitation, and then it continued because I am a chronic snoozer. So I got out of bed and turned off my alarm, and I got back into bed. I used my favorite trick, which is if you get into the same exact position you were in when you woke up from a dream, you can go back into the dream.
No kidding.
I don't know how I figured this
out. We're coming in hot with this interview.
Yeah. So I don't know how or when I figured this out. I've taught my kids this, so I have a little bit of external validation, but give it a try, those of you who haven't.
Yeah.
If you want to return to a dream, snap your body back into the same position, fingers, toes, arms, the whole thing of it, and see if you can access that same dream again. So I was able to do that through, unfortunately, 3 or 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
And I only say unfortunately because I don't sleep alone and my poor lover is next to me. Having to deal with me get up every 9 minutes and reset the clock. But so the dream felt more like a conversation as we went because when I first awoke, it was a sense of, oh, wow, you're here. How interesting. And I wonder why and what's the message. And then I realized I wanted to hear more. So I went back and asked them, what are you trying to tell me?
Oh.
And then towards the end, I was able to explain some things and then leave with a little bit of insight on why I was having that reflection and how important it is for me to accept that I can swear on your show, right?
Yeah.
I am a grown-ass woman And yeah. I'm making informed decisions as a 51-year-old about this majestic, amazing life I get to live. And I can welcome the perspectives of my elders and embrace them for looking after me, and also maybe not do exactly what they would do if they were me.
Yes.
So it was an exchange, which was so cool. And most certainly, yeah, definitely. It was sparked by a conversation I had with my dad last night. We saw my father for dinner, and then there was a follow-up phone call, and I realized there was more. He wasn't just speaking for him. He was actually speaking for his sister and his father and maybe his father's parents. There's a lineage that I'm at the end of that I'm connected to. And that was super cool. So
last question, and I'll move forward. But this is so interesting to me. Also, because I just had a dream like this probably a couple weeks ago where it was my dad came through. He's been past 10 years now. And that's why I asked you the question around dream or visitation, is I woke up feeling like I've never had a dream like that before. It was literally felt like we hung out, and kind of like similar situation, I imagine, what you're describing, like an event in present day real world here happens and sparks up some emotion and so forth. And the same thing was happening on my side. Then all of a sudden I have this dream that I just remember I got to the washroom and I'm like, what happened? And I was pretty emotional most of the morning. So then I journaled about this whole experience. Then I brought it to Carl Jung and kind of continued and actually wrote a little bit about it. But so I'm curious, like, for you, what have you done since, I guess? I mean, it's still very fresh, of course. Like, how I know you don't have this every time you go to sleep, so maybe we're workshopping this live, but like, what? Yeah, I guess where do you go from here with the insight and the wisdom?
Well, like you, I'm a writer, and I write to learn, and I write to understand, and I write to heal, and I write to offer whatever that might be to anyone who, if it's a public writing, might read it. I am already thinking about how I can write to metabolize the experience and what the learning is for me. I don't meditate every single morning. The aspirational me does, but this morning I definitely found the time and sat down in front of my altar and lit a candle and had about 10 minutes to just kind of take some space between my earliest morning activities and waking up my youngest kid. And that was helpful. And then part of it had to do with my relationship, and my person and I were in the kitchen. Also, all of this is before 7:30 a.m.
It's a big day.
Such
big
is day. Life. And, you know, he's kind of feeding the dog and we're doing what we're doing. And I also just kind of shared the insight with him. So also just verbalizing it is super helpful, because sometimes our dreams, I sometimes feel like our dreams are communicating in almost a more simple base imagery first, feelings first language. Have you ever had that experience, Mark, when you wake up and you want to either tell somebody about a dream or you want to write it down, and it's actually impossible to verbalize it?
Yeah, it's the feeling. It's like a direct line, almost heart to heart, is the only way I can describe, at least what I just experienced a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. And
hard to put words to that.
Yeah. And it's almost like we almost risk eroding it or diminishing it or reshaping it when we try to put it into words. But it felt important to me, you know, in that first couple hours after awakening, to try to distill the takeaway, because I also forget dreams so much more quickly than I forget things that happen in our real life analog physical world.
Yeah,
it's a more ethereal, delicate memory. And sometimes I find if I can talk about it, it sticks with me a little longer. So part of it was selfish on my part. I just wanted to capture it so it didn't slip away by lunchtime. But anyway, yeah, no, I think, you know, we'll see. I might even end up talking with my dad about it a little bit. It might have been my dreams giving me a little bit of insight into how to have a continued conversation with my dad. I'm curious, what about you when you had this, you know, some weeks ago dream of spending time or being in presence with your dad?
Yeah.
Is there a net, like a takeaway or like a shift that happened as a result?
Yeah. There have been a couple really coincidental things that happen within literally the day of and the day after, which I can provide some detail. But the main thing, and this is what the counsel, like my counsel, gave to me, like the core of it after having a chat with them was really to just be with it. Like be with, because that, again, like I've had many dreams, of course, like all of us, I think we dream every night, but you know, you have small little memories and so forth, but it was just that visitation, you know, it doesn't even feel like a dream. That visitation was so different that, you know, the advice was just to be with that energy and like feel your dad there with you throughout that whole experience. And that's where, like, gosh, like it was the next morning I had a meeting with actually my men's group and shared this whole experience. And one of the guys in the group were co-writing a fiction book together, actually, which is kind of based off the nonfiction. He's like, you're not going to believe this, but he's doing most of the writing for this. I mean, as you know, with writing, I can't write two books. I barely could write one.
Oh my
so
gosh,
I worked on the nonfiction. He's doing the fiction. He said the day before, he said, I wrote a whole scene where the main character finds and visits his dad for the first time, and it all happens through a dream. So things like that. You can't ignore that kind of stuff.
No, you can't. It's beautiful.
Yeah. So I shared it too. I shared it with my wife and just for the same reasons you did, to really kind of cement it and definitely did some journaling and so forth. And even just talking about it now with you, I mean, is bringing it. That's the difference, I think, is I can still see and feel definitely the energy of that dream or visitation quite profoundly versus really anything else I've ever experienced. So I think maybe that's the gift, right? Whoever shows up in these experiences for us, like they're still there, right?
Yeah.
Wow. What a way to start, coming in hot.
Right out of the gates, baby.
Right out of the gates. Oh, gosh. Okay, so maybe this does relate, or maybe this, who knows? We'll see where it goes. But I did want to ask, when it comes to, of course, your book, Undimmed, what were the whispers? And maybe it was a dream, but were there any whispers kind of along the journey that got you to, okay, we're going to do this. Like, we're going to write about this experience and this journey that I'm on and really put it out to the world in a book fashion or whatever, however that showed up in the first place. But like, what were some of the whispers or questions that were coming up for you?
Yeah. Such a good question. I think, well, first of all, I should note, I never really set out to do this project. I didn't have hopes of being an author and revealing so much of my personal journey and experience in a book like this. What I did was I wrote to heal and understand and learn about what was happening as my life was changing so significantly after what appeared to be an insignificant shift. And so I wrote for a long time just kind of essays trying to understand my own experience. And you know, one thing a lot of people don't realize, unless they're writers themselves, is that writing is a solitary experience. Yeah. We are alone with our thoughts and a way to write, whether that's by hand or on keyboard. And whether you create time for introspection and reflection in your life or not, you are guaranteed to have abundant hours of introspection and reflection if you choose to write about something personal. It's inevitable. You can't, it's impossible that you can't get there unless you do that. And so through this process of kind of metabolizing and in some ways maybe even purging what I was trying to understand, so much writing came out. At the same time, in that window, 2018-19, I was following other people, primarily on Instagram, actually, who were going through similar experiences and also writing about them. And I realized my experience was slightly different than the people I was following. And then I got into this really intense Quitlet chapter where I read literally 20 or 30 books on the journey of recovery or addiction or healing or, you know, parents dealing with kids and their journeys, whatever it might be. And I didn't see anything out there that matched my experience. And it felt unique. And I also along the way realized that if I had guidance that matched what I was needing and crafting for myself in that moment, if I'd had something like that to help my mom or to help me earlier on, our lives would have been a little bit smoother and easier. And so it felt like a compulsion after a little while. Like, I'm called to do this. And
it's like a live workbook based on where you're at, right?
It is very much so. And it's not over. It's ongoing. And it's humbling and awkward and fun and exciting and terrifying and invigorating and all of the things. And I think the whisper was, you know, in some ways, I love this question. In some ways, it came from other people that I brought to me who I knew would tell me what I needed to hear. So, for example, one of the tools I offer up in the book is when we're trying to tune into our intuition, we can kind of notice who do we go to for advice, right? Like, we already know in our gut most of the time the right answer to a big choice or question. And we could just take a step back and notice, what articles are we reading? What things are we following? What podcasts are we listening to? What family members or friends are we going to consult with? And kind of notice what we're seeking out. Is it the more conservative approach or the more liberal approach to an issue? And that can kind of help us discern our intuition. And I noticed I found ways to spend time with authors and people who had a lot of conviction about my work and message, and people who had moved through the fear of publishing. And so all of their communications to me were, do this book. Sure. And so over time, I realized I knew that all along. I just needed to find half a dozen people to tell me directly, in person, face-to-face, eye-to-eye.
You're like, so okay, I can't ignore this anymore.
Exactly.
But I think something that's really interesting that I think you're bringing up in that share, or at least my reflection back on what you shared, is that you can get all of this guidance and these messages, and I think we all have them, and we're surrounded by these like intuitive nudges and so forth and people all the time. But this is where just the topic of being like dimmed or undimmed really comes into effect, because, the work that I do over here as well, like most people are in survival mode with their minds, and their minds are so full. And like, it's just really hard to then hear the messages and even take the meeting with the authors or schedule that time. Like, it's there, but it's like we have to clean up the space first to be able to actually get to the message, get to the path and so forth. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, that's its own discipline, right? I mean, we are so easily distracted today, and there's so many ways to avoid listening to ourselves. Mm. And so just that first step of choosing to create space to hear ourselves is a huge kind of movement forward in the right direction. Yeah. And, you know, what a gift. It becomes its own kind of addiction once we do tap into it, because it's incredibly powerful to have access to prompt conviction. Like, you walk into a place and you think, I'm going to do this event here, or this is something I want to bring into my life. Or you meet somebody and you have that clear, this is somebody who I know I want to see again. Or vice versa. You enter a place and you know promptly, this is not a place where I want to spend my energy and my time. Or I am in the company of a human being who is on their own path and I'm on mine, and I would prefer to not bump into theirs again. Okay.
Exactly. Well said.
And it frees up so much bandwidth for what we do want to do in life. And so I think that there's kind of a decluttering that has to happen. I actually refer to Marie Kondo's work as a verb in the book, as like, Marie Kondo your world. Like, if it's not useful and it's not bringing you joy, whatever it is, move it out of the way so that you can have more access to the important stuff. And that starts with the most important, you know, inside of ourselves. our own guidance, our own intuition, our own feelings, our own senses of right and wrong and where we could or should maybe go.
So would you suggest, you know, not everyone obviously is going to go down the journey of writing a book on a topic and so forth, but what I found, I took note of, I think, the prep that you went down or that you did to actually even start writing the book, you know, reviewing your lineage and doing a bit of a journal review and then writing, you know, letters that were never sent. And so like that, these are all things that I think any one of us, I don't want to say should, but I invite people to explore, right? To kind of like, it's like a nice natural way to do a bit of an audit to see, okay, what's up over here? Like where am I maybe not being, as true to myself as I can be, or not showing up in the best light, and where are the addictions, whether that's alcohol or content, or I mean, name, there's a million different things out there. And then we can kind of start cleaning things up. Is that how you started the journey?
You know, you make it sound so deliberate and well-designed. I wish I could say it was.
Say yes.
I really just was, I honestly, if it sounds great, brilliant, right? For me, I really just got into a mode of investigation. You know, my experience was take a 30-day break from something that I had been using in a habitual way that had been standing between me and my intuition and good decision-making.
Yeah,
and then I realized, which was alcohol, yeah. And then I realized that was awesome. I'm going to keep going. And so that extended months and then into a year. And here we are almost 9 years later. And throughout that process, I was just persistently curious. And I think if anything, I wouldn't necessarily say that people should or shouldn't get into their curiosity or about their history or their path or where they've been. For some people, that's actually really not healthy. It's better to kind of leave some stuff behind. Yeah. But for those of us, we all have curiosity about something. I think being comfortable with how okay that is and going into those spaces just to sort of see what's there. And you can open doors and windows and decide you want to keep going, or you can open doors and windows and say, that's enough. I don't really need to keep going down that path. I had this really significantly in connection with trying to understand, I wanted to get to the why. Like, why was my family system set in certain ways? Why was I raised to not talk about pain or difficulty or feelings? What was it that kind of shaped my parents into those orientations in those years when they were raising us? And what shaped them into those orientations when they were kids? And so I was sort of following the breadcrumbs back. And I had this moment where I got to this pretty significant event that happened in my family in 1985, when my first cousin was kidnapped, raped, and murdered here in Northern California. And it was something that was such a meteoric tragedy that just kind of like, I've described it as a needle across the record, like, yeah, life is going da-di-da-di-da-di-da, and then stop, and it's never the same again. Like, everything changed after that, and we never really talked about it. And so here I was, almost 40 years after the fact, finally recognizing what a significant moment that was, and I followed my curiosity with it. I actually got into press archives. I read the articles. I read a recent interview of her friend Survivor, who had her version of what had happened and what her life is like now. And then I talked to a couple family members about that time and what was it like and how did we make these decisions. And so it wasn't necessarily that I was thinking about using this as material for a book. In fact, I was extremely careful about maybe not oversharing it because some of my family doesn't really want to revisit this. But the curiosity kind of led me into other areas. And so I think if somebody is doing their own, you know, healing or discovery or exploration, or if there's a book that's coming out of personal experience, it is a real, it's a real, both a discipline and also an opportunity to really truly tune into what is interesting or not and follow it. And if you have to travel somewhere, or get in some old archives, figure something out, find those old journals, you know, talk to a family member who knew you when you were 4 years old, whatever it might be. That could be so fun and yield so much, whether without even thinking about what the output or the outcome might be, just to be in the process.
Well, that's the beauty of just, I think, just natural curiosity, right? And it's so interesting how you, you know, kind of checked in feeling very like childlike, essentially, you know, this morning with the dream and so forth, and that kind of curiosity. I mean, that's literally, we're born like that. And it's why we're able to learn how to walk and like, okay, yeah, I'm going to reach out over here and grab onto this, you know, countertop and see what happens. I mean, it just happens naturally, right?
Yeah.
So to come back in and I guess just, I like your balance, your respectful balance, though, that this is not maybe for everyone. Because I was about to say, you know, you pull the thread a little bit. You know, some people may not want to do that in certain areas. And, of course, you know, that's totally okay. But I think there are enough other buckets and topics where we can do that and get just really interesting information that ultimately becomes helpful as we try to navigate this game of life that we're all playing, you know?
Yeah. You know, I'd also add that, you know, with book writing, and you're now in your second book journey, and I'm in a maybe second book journey, you know, one thing that arises is this awareness around how deep we actually will go on a topic if we choose to craft a book about it. Yeah. It's not a small exercise. It's actually years of your life that you will be learning about, talking about, telling other people about, self-promoting on. It's just insane the amount of energy and cycles. So to do any of this work or research or exploration on something that you can't wait to do every day, I would actually say is foolish. Like, don't start a project because you think the world needs it. Or it's a good idea for the market right now. Unless that's your deal and you're doing, you know, high volume business books as a strategy. If you're doing something in a more conventional authorship sense, or even filmmaking, I imagine it's very similar. Yeah. It better be something that you cannot get enough of.
And something you need right now. That's the difference I've noticed in the second book journey. I mean, the first book was really helpful going through the process and so forth. But as I kind of look at it in retrospect, it was a little bit more of a look back around, okay, well, these are either interviews that I had or people that I've studied, and like writing it up from that place. Whereas, as you can probably tell with just like the fact that I brought the dream with my dad to the council, and that's in the book as of now. We'll see what happens with editors. But like, I'm using it because I need it now.
Yes, I'm having the same experience.
Right?
That's great. Yeah, like what do we actually feel like we need or we want, and then start there instead of producing something that's sort of capturing what's already been learned, right?
I think
that's a really common first book experience is, I did this whole thing and I figured this all out and I wrote about it in the process and here's the thing and I hope it helps other people. Great. And then for a second, it's a little bit more of a, ooh, there are all these like kind of little caves and pathways I want to go into.
True.
And I don't know if I totally have the courage to do it, but if I commit to writing about the journey, I'll take the journey.
Exactly. I mean, just FYI though, for anyone trying to pitch a book to publishers, hard to put that in a proposal where like, I'm not 100% sure of the ending of this because I'm going through it,
you know,
as we speak. But I mean, to your point, still very much worth the adventure. Very much. You know what I've really enjoyed about your book so far? I'm about halfway through. I'm listening to it, which is beautiful because I have your voice most days. And I think you alluded to this as you were, you know, as you were reading books and kind of seeing that like, these don't exactly match kind of where I'm at in my life and so forth. And I've had and I'm sure others have told you this at this point, but I'm having kind of the exact opposite experience listening to your book around, like, I've got two young boys. We're still very much in like story time, and there's things in there, right, of like the rushing of the pages, and like, I know exactly what she's talking about, and I feel like a terrible dad when I do that. And it just, it gives you, like, so there are moments like that where it gives you, at least for me, permission to think, well, I'm not a terrible dad. I mean, this is just a moment and so forth. And, you know, it just gives a reframe. And I think with the alcohol, same thing. I mean, there's a lot of people, of course, that talk about the extremes of alcohol and, you know, being like full on alcoholics and so forth versus, I think there's a huge amount of people. And I would say I'm in this camp as well of just being like, I don't know. I mean, I have a drink here and there and, but I'm not like super happy with how I feel afterwards. And then we obviously are in a huge topic around, like, there's no, there's nothing good about alcohol. I mean, I think that we can probably, in terms of the health benefits, yeah. like maybe sure. there's some social things there, but, so that's all kind of out. So it's a bit of a play in the, like, it's a wrestling in the mind and you really go down that journey. And I think, like I said, there's so many of us, I think, that are in that, almost like a between space or, dare I say the average, I don't know, but not in the extremes. I think that's what I'm trying to, you know, to say.
Well, you're right. I mean, you're right. There is, we live in a culture where there's very binary messaging about alcohol specifically that you either drink responsibly, like everybody who's good and fun and capable, and if you can't drink responsibly, then you have a disease and you go over there. And there are people who can help you over there and you can never drink again for the rest of your life. And if you do, we're going to shame you and worry about you and brand you and all that. What that doesn't do is acknowledge this group of, my research indicates, roughly 80 million Americans alone who are questioning their relationship with alcohol. And a lot of that is thanks to the increased awareness around the health risks. And thank goodness the final erosion of the red wine myth. Thank you to 60 Minutes 1990s episode and on and on.
Your heart health.
Our heart health has nothing to do with wine. Full stop. Like, full stop. Anyway, I digress. So I think that there are a lot of people who are questioning their relationship. And also it gets even more tricky when maybe somebody doesn't have an issue with something, and let's even make it not about alcohol. It could be Instagram. It could be sugar. Yeah. It could be work or late night spending online. Like, I don't know. We all do things because life is uncomfortable sometimes and we need a little quick hit of escape. This is humanity. Yeah. And we say, okay, well, this isn't an addiction. I'm gonna just take a break and prove to myself I'm not addicted to this thing. And then we get partway through the amount of time we thought we were going to endure without it, and it's really hard. And it's either really hard and just uncomfortable hard, or it's really hard, and then we give in and we do the thing we said we weren't going to do. And then it's, do I tell the people who I love and know who are supporting me through this that I had a slip-up? Does the slip-up mean that I actually am in a problem state? Do I do this again? Do I hide it? Is it bad if I'm hiding? It's just the spiral of kind of self-shaming can get really, really dark very fast and cause all kinds of relationship and other problems. So one thing that is really critical, I think, to this exploration is what I refer to in the book as self-grace. And the best way to describe self-grace is with this gesture, just hand on heart. Mm. Like, we are doing the best we can in any given moment with the resources we have available to us. And sometimes we're going to be immaculate with our commitments and words, and sometimes we're going to blow it. And it doesn't mean that we're a bad person or a bad father or we have a disease or an addiction. It just means that we're human. And, you know, I love this. Elena Brower says this phrase a lot in her recent book. How human of me. How human of me. Like, how beautifully, like, imperfect of me that I'm imperfect in this moment. It's really, really key to remember that. And, you know, the invitation of the book that I think you're touching on is to just start paying attention. You know, like, what are we noticing? I love the messages I'm getting from readers right now, sharing what they're noticing now that they didn't notice before. That's really all this has to be. Like, I noticed myself opening the freezer and reaching for the Häagen-Dazs after having a crappy conversation with my teen daughter And I noticed that that was something I thought was going to help me feel good for a few minutes. And then I noticed that when I do eat ice cream at 10 o'clock at night, I don't feel good when I sleep and I don't feel happy with myself the next morning. And so I noticed that I had the ability to put it back and close the refrigerator and make myself a cup of herbal tea instead. Yeah. Beautiful. It doesn't mean ice cream is bad. It doesn't mean you're a criminal if you had the ice cream, but just like deepening our self-awareness in the multitude of decisions we get to make every hour of every day can be so life-changing.
I think that's the beauty of this kind of work where, to your point, I mean, just even like I'm noticing as well, just going through this, through your book, like just different areas of life, and you catch yourself and you give yourself the luxury of a pause. And that's a, I think I'm biased, of course, but I think that's a superpower in today's age. Those who continue to build that skill, which I think it can be trained and so forth. And the more we clear up the mind, that more helpful it is. Like that's when you start seeing what others can't see, not just with yourself, but whether that's a business strategy or asking a question or making a decision, you know, there's actually a beautiful world surrounding us. There's a bit of a chaotic world as well. But if you just get stuck in the chaos, it's really hard to see the beauty and see the path from that place.
Yeah.
Right. And we miss it. Totally. And I think the other thing, like I remember you were speaking about, I can't remember if it was 1 month or 3 months that you hadn't had a drink, but you were, I think you were at a really nice restaurant and you're like, this is, if there's going to be any place to have a nice glass of wine, this is it. And I just noticed too, it's funny how much we're so good at negotiating in our mind, like the amount of chatter and how fast that happens. Like I remember reading the dialogue there, like, oh, well, I got to this point. I feel I can have one glass of wine. And do I have one glass? Do I have two glasses? Like with how fast? Like it's so wild, right? But I totally relate to that. And then you ended up having a glass of wine. And I think you continued that this is what I'm reading out of it. Like continued it in a way that felt balanced to you. It didn't feel like you're, you know, kind of like overboard in drinking until I think there was a bigger moment around the holidays. But like, I guess, like, how do you handle moments like that? Maybe it's not like that for alcohol for you since you haven't had any for quite some time, but there are probably other habits that you have or addictions, let's just say, maybe that's a heavy label, but where, yeah, you do, you know, you catch yourself, you're like, yeah, okay, I had the glass of wine at dinner and, you know,
yeah,
it's okay, but I'm going to reset or what? Like, where do we go from there, I guess?
Yeah, no, it's an important moment. I think it depends, a couple of questions. What's the goal? Like, what's the goal? Like, sugar is a really easy one for me to play with because I'm always trying to eat less sugar, like many of us are. And I also think there's a lot of beauty in just occasionally enjoying sugar. Like,
yeah.
Whether it's a special moment of a birthday or ice cream cone with your niece or whatever, like it's good to also not be so rigid about stuff. And so if I find that if I have a good relationship and understanding with my why, my why for wanting to eat less sugar is because it's healthier for my body in a variety of ways. And then I understand also that if I do have occasional sugar, if there's a kind of a moment that I'm sharing or the lack of rigidity is appropriate at a special dinner party or whatever it is, like I can harmonize inside with that decision and not have fuck it language going on, but instead conscious decision language. I'm choosing this in this moment. Yeah. It's a big difference. And, and so I think, first of all, is just bringing awareness to those choices so they're not passive choices.
Yeah.
You know, another one for me is busyness. Like my default escape route is a calendar that looks like my calendar this week and next week and the week after. And most hours are accounted for in some way between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. and often well into the evenings. And I can look at that and see that that's me not being disciplined about how I use what is most valuable to me these days, which is my time. And is there something in me that is uncomfortable with 2 or 3 hours of inactivity in my calendar.
Look out. And it's crazy talk.
That's the like, well, what would happen if I woke up tomorrow morning, yeah, canceled all my meetings, and walked on the beach for 2 hours?
Yeah.
Instead of serving, responding, engaging, producing, writing, inviting, you know, all the things that I do all day long. And so I've found that just having the awareness of that is sometimes most of what I need. And yeah, I can then say, okay, well, clearly I'm engaging in this way to avoid something. Let's find some good time to unavoid it. Sure. Let's find some good time to like take a 24-hour, you know, pause. I love that you use the word pause, and create a little space for that introspection and reflection. You know, it also might be a little bit of a writing withdrawal. I don't know if you've gone through this, but when I'm in writing mode, I'm up every day and at the laptop with a candle, usually from 5 to 7 a.m.
God, we're on the same schedule. And this is very,
really, I'm not surprised.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
And that is guaranteed introspection, reflection time. Mm-hmm. And when I'm not in a writing mode, I use those hours in different ways, sometimes really healthy ways and sometimes less. But I'm noticing now that it's kind of on me to make sure that I still have that muscle exercised and the spaciousness for what that serves in my life in other ways that I don't in writing mode.
Do you have any way or any consistent rituals that allow you to, I guess, do consistent audits of, like, to your point, I mean, you have a jammed week, you know, is it like Friday afternoon, you take a look at the week ahead and maybe make some adjustments or so forth, or like, I guess just, yeah, like what are some practices that are, I guess, practical in the sense of just keeping somewhat of a balance and things in check so it doesn't run away and it kind of be off the rails?
Yeah. Well, the one you mentioned is a big one. I definitely on Sunday at some point take a careful, comprehensive look at the week. Okay. I live, you know, 15-minute drive from San Francisco. The Wisdom Ventures business brings us into the city many days, and I always kind of want to take a look at how much time am I spending in the car, doing meetings in person, meetings online. I have my son, my younger one, every other week, okay, and the weeks that I have him, I like to be finished by 3 or 4 because I either want to go to a sports event or be around at home if he's home. And so that's a really lovely forced discipline of just cutting the days a little bit tighter and not starting them until after he's gone to school. You know, gloves are off when he's not with me because I'll start doing calls sometimes, yeah, you know, 6 or 7 a.m. and work late and dinners and another dinner and whatever. So that's a good one. I also really value the kind of quarterly cycles also throughout the year. You know, equinox and solstice are kind of forced moments of reflection for me. And mm-hmm, I'm so blessed in my community of friends. A lot of people around me take those really seriously also. So they're often like burns at the beach or, yeah, you know, a cacao ceremony, or, you know, we've hosted circles in our home on the winter solstice most of the last 5 years, where we just kind of pause and like have a little bit of seasonally imposed forced reflection around the time of the year and how are we doing, and are we in a wintering phase, are we in a birthing phase, and how are we allowing the way that we're living to support our input or our output. That's been really, really helpful. And then about a year and a half ago, we figured out a way to have a partial share of a home that's about 2.5 hours away from here up on the coast here in Northern California. And I have a pretty consistent ritual of going up there by myself for 2 or 3 nights every 2 or 3 months. And
that's nice.
It is essential time. And I learned of this ritual, or kind of was inspired to do this, by Roshi Joan Halifax, the founding abbot at Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico, a very dear person in our lives. She has an hermitage up at 9,000 feet altitude in New Mexico with a couple caves and a very simple building. And she lives a very busy public life with a lot of discourse and service and engagement and organizations. And she learned decades ago that she needs to retreat regularly. Yeah. If she's able to be of service in the world and be the teacher and the founder and the guide and leader that she is, her self-resourcing is solitude and quiet. And that is absolutely my self-resourcing.
Yes, I need that.
Yeah. So it serves a bunch of purposes. First of all, just to like recharge the batteries, bring all the nervous system levels down, sometimes catch up on sleep, you know, experiment with new food or beverage or something if I'm taking care of my body in some way. But it also is great reflection time. You know, I can kind of pull out my lists and think about, do I actually want to take on this big project or not? I have two big projects right now that I'm considering, and I'm going up there on Monday because need to just hunker down and frame these out and actually look at the next 3 years of my life and say, is this what I want to spend such a huge portion of my bandwidth, life force on?
Yeah.
And I need quiet to do that.
I suspect there might be a few more dreams in the next little while.
That'd be great.
You know, put those questions to the council.
I need the council. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so important though. And I mean, maybe I'm a bit biased because I get to hang out with awesome humans like you, but it still feels like there's not as many people talking about these intentional times away, right? The 2 or 3 day resets. Like I see it over and over, especially studying these ancient teachers. I mean, they're all doing things like this, right? But I also see it in present day, many, not all, but many, you know, leaders and so forth that are doing really interesting things in the world. They just, it's not the narrative that gets picked up, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see how it's essential. Like I shouldn't say you can't, but it's really hard to operate nonstop in the current landscape that we live in, like 12, 14 hour, like high intensity workouts for a mind without any kind of recovery or stopping built in. So like we need those moments. And I think also where we need to do a little bit better, I'm not saying you, I mean us in general, is taking like slices of the time away. And then like, how do you have micro moments like that daily?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that it doesn't become this, like, I have to go there. I have to do this.
Yeah. And you don't want to be redlining when you get out.
Yeah. Yeah. No one wins there.
You're making me realize one thing I'm aware of, and I had a lot of conversation with myself and my publisher about and working on Undimmed, is that to be able to take 2 or 3 days as a breather is an enormous privilege. Many of us are, you know, working 5, 6, 7 days a week and or have care obligations or requirements for people younger than us or older than us. More and more of the people in my life these days are tending to aging parents, and it's an enormous emotional, physical, and financial strain on many of them. Although they wouldn't have it in any other way, they don't have the freedom to go away for 2 or 3 days because they're the person that's supporting the person, their loved one. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there are a whole variety of reasons why people might not be able to do that. I really encourage folks who do have access to something like what I just described, a share of a house, or a, you know, a guest room in their home with a private entrance, or an extra spot in a retreat that didn't fill up that they're hosting. You know, I'm kind of talking more to your guests maybe than the average American right now. One of the most beautiful and important things we can do actually goes to the 8th awareness, which is find somebody who would really benefit from that and gift it to them. Gift it to somebody who really needs a weekend away. I mean, we have somebody in our life right now who's in a really complicated brand new relationship, and we're trying to find ways to help her get a couple of days away, you know, just to catch her breath. One of the owners of this place that I'm referring to up the coast, she's a very successful Google executive. She actually bought her share not for herself, but to gift her 8 weeks a year to 8 different creatives who need a week to just go create.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I love that.
You know, it doesn't have to be anything grand. It could also be like if you have office space they're not using for a week, who do we know who might really, really appreciate a private office space for a week that they've never had something like that. So I don't know. It's a gift.
Right? You feel good. They feel good. It's just this beautiful circle of gratitude when you're thinking in those terms, right?
Yeah.
But I will say too, like, and this is not me. This is my book council kind of reflecting back, especially Black Elk, one of the indigenous elders on the council. And he always comes back with me. He's like, you, I'm paraphrasing here, but he's like, you lovely folks in the Western world always want to go to the mountain, but the mountain, you can bring the mountain right to you. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and I know what you're saying in the sense that, of course, yeah, there is privilege in going somewhere and for 2 or 3 days, and not everyone can get away to do that. But I also do believe that we all have access to something. Yeah. And he reminds me of that often, of like, maybe it is that transition between this thing and that thing where you take a moment. And yeah, it's not 3 days, but those moments, just like, I always think of James Clear, who's been on the show in the past as well, of habit stacking. It's the same thing. Those moments stack and end up, you know, probably, I'd have to, I don't know if I have science on this, but I'm willing to bet that those moments probably stack to more days than the 2 or 3 days of going away kind of thing, right? If you really are doing those consistently. So
yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, we all,
and that can
something.
Be just a walk around the block. I mean,
yeah,
the, you know, reset the meeting schedule so they're 50 minutes instead of 1 hour.
Totally.
Take a 10-minute walk 5 times a day. It's going to be a different day.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, time has flown
so
fast, actually. So fast. I want to thank you for, well, A, just you being you. And it's just been, we've been kind of friends from afar for many years now. And I want to thank you for that. It's, I deeply appreciate our connection. And thank you for writing this book and putting yourself out there and continuing to write and sharing it with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions at this point. And I guess my final question is just, you know, when someone puts down the book, what do you hope that they feel?
I mean, the first word that just immediately came to mind was seen. I really hope people feel seen.
Yeah.
There's no one path or one way to grow or shift or evolve. And I, you know, in a previous version of this book, I went through the whole metaphor of imaginals and how the caterpillar goes to full on goo before it can sprout itself into a butterfly. It's a little bit overplayed at this point. But I remember when I first heard that metaphor, it just melted me. Like, yeah. Of course things have to fall apart sometimes. And then I've gotten more fascinated with the seasons and cycles in nature. Of course, you know, think about leaves and trees and blooming, you know, plants. Those are what attract, what make them able to perpetuate or reproduce, right? They nourish them with the chlorophyll. There's all this beauty. And then regularly, all has to die and fall to the ground. And we bring all of our energy and life force inside. And we kind of hunker down for a little while. And then we regroup and we rebloom again. And I really think it's okay to accept that life is going to be and get messy. And if we're in a dark place, it's just because we're in that part of the cycle.
That season, yeah.
And that's okay. You didn't do anything wrong. This is just part of the journey. I hope people feel
and
seen.
And I think when you feel seen like that, and I'm speaking from my experience, I've shared a couple of the moments in the book where I really felt seen. You just feel lighter in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful gift that you're giving all of us. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. You too. I'm so curious to see and learn more about your counsel and follow along with what you're offering through that work. And it feels really important. So thank you.